The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
Once again, we're lucky to have him from the Bretton Woods Conference taking place right now in New Hampshire. Bretton Woods 2014, The Founders and the Future. It's being organized by the Center for Financial Stability. And we would like to welcome to the program Nick Sargent, Chief Economist at Fort Washington Investment Advisors. Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, my pleasure.
So a huge array of stellar guests, from Sheila Bair to Charles Goodhart, who's a member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, to 2000. John Taylor is there. Otmar Issing, we were lucky to speak with him earlier on. And you, of course, you're on a panel entitled How to Better Anticipate and Manage Future Crises. That took place this morning. What conclusions did the panel come to?
Well, I think that, it would vary by who the speaker. Professor Robert Aliber, emeritus of the University of Chicago, has been writing about bubbles. And so what are the causes of bubbles? And so one of his themes is that there's been an increasing number of financial crises in the last 30 years, that everybody seems to react as if they're one-off, but in fact they have common causes. And he attributed it particular to huge capital inflows that go into countries that then drive up their currency values and security prices to unsustainable levels, and then the process reverses. Then we had Paul Tucker from the Bank of formerly with the Bank of England, and his main take is what made the crisis so severe was just that banks globally, and especially in Europe, were tremendously undercapitalized. So if anything went wrong, they were vulnerable. My own take is that the crisis was the intersection of three things happening. One, housing prices being too high in the bubble. Secondly, a credit risk was systematically mispriced, meaning too cheap. And then three, I think that the problem was that so many investors missed was the vulnerability of the largest financial institutions. And the problem is that, you don't have access on what their exposures are. So that's why it caught so many investors by surprise.
Okay, so I suppose all three were related, and it's impossible to put it down to just one thing. Anyway, it becomes a vicious cycle when a crisis starts, and it's confidence in the end in many of the areas that you've been speaking about, from house prices to credit risk to large banks. So, with that said, credit risk, is it now priced too cheap with central bank intervention around the world?
Well, I think you have to say that that's certainly a potential concern. So one concern that that we have is in this very low interest rate environment, the absolute level of interest rates for bonds, whether they're investment grade or high yield, we're at record lows. So that doesn't leave you much, margin for error. And also the spreads that they generate over U.S. Treasuries are kind of back to pre-crisis levels. So I think that that is a legitimate concern. And, the real question, of course, is what happens when the Fed has to begin tightening, presumably sometime a year from now?
So there are two takes on that. One is that the Fed will manage to engineer a smooth exit, that inflation concerns are maybe a little bit overdone. And the other is that there's going to be an all-out exit panic for the doors. Where do the majority of the panel come down?
It was interesting. I offered more my view. The others are less involved in the directly in the markets. So my view is I'm less fearful that inflation is going to rear its ugly head, in the next year or two. We can leave open the longer-term prognosis. My argument is that the Fed, I think, is going to move very gradually, 25 basis points at a time, as they did, after the tech And then the real question is, they will get tested along the way.
Nick has been telling us about his panel earlier, how to better anticipate and manage future crises. He shared the panel with Robert Alaber, co-author of Manias, Panics and Crashes, History of Crises, that real textbook on crises, and Paul Tucker, Deputy Governor and MPC member of the Bank of England up to 2013. So, Nick Sargent, back to you. You were just telling us that your view is you're less fearful inflation is going to rear its head in the next year or two at least, and the Fed in the US will be able to manage the path to normalization, gradually increasing rates by, say, 25 basis points a meeting. However, we're seeing bonds selling off just a little bit today. The 10-year down 14.30 seconds, the yield up to 2.44%. And we have some big bond investors like Jeff Gundlach saying it's all over. Is this the beginning of the end of the bond market rally?
I think so. And the principal reason being that, the economic data coming out of the U.S. is just pointed consistently towards the economy regaining the momentum that it lost at the beginning of the year. So I've been scratching my head for a long time about yields being this low, and the only explanation that made any sense to me was that, of course, the European situation is so different, as we know. So I thought that, it was interesting then today and yesterday and today on the back of the stronger data, finally, the bond market reacting to the strength of the U.S. economic news, less fearful of the weakness in Europe, perhaps because of the ECB actions.
Yes, indeed. Now, does this pick up steam?
Well, that'll be something I'm not 100% sure of. A lot is going to come down to the data. You know, I would say after we posted the 4% plus growth in the second quarter, kind of the consensus for the current quarter is still about 3% and change. So I think that's largely priced in. So therefore, to see a major surge in bond yields, I think what you have to have is surprises north of that type of number. And obviously, the next text is going to come then with the jobs report. But where I'm coming from is for a while the data was disappointing, then the data were mixed. And now I do find it encouraging that the data are consistently coming out on the stronger than expected side.
And yet we do have prominent economists still sort of sounding warning bells, including this morning Chris Lowe saying, really, we haven't seen enough to make us believe in 3% plus annualized growth for the year. The consumer is still saving, not spending the money that's needed to make, the economy go around.
Yes. And I would say to that, I don't expect 3%. That was the expectation everybody thought at the beginning of the year, including yours truly. And then, of course, we got the negative growth in the first quarter. So to be clear, I'm not expecting that you're going to post a 3% number for the calendar year. But what I do believe is that 3% growth, on a kind of trend basis, is attainable. And the basic reason is if you look at the private sector of the economy, so take out the government sector, that actually has been growing at a 3% pace for several years. But we were facing, with the austerity and the effort to bring the budget deficit down, fiscal drag. And so the basic argument is that that is going to be less of a negative in the next year than it has been in the past 2 years.
All right. So on that note, and we haven't mentioned it yet in the program, so I'll take this opportunity, if you don't mind, the trade deficit improving quite substantially last month by about, $2 billion, came in at $40.5 billion. That's a positive sign, I guess, for trade.
Well, that's right. When I look at the trade, I don't just look at the balance. What I try to look at is, are the exports picking up and the imports picking up? Because if I see that going on, that gives me greater assurance that the economy is growing. Both, we can import more if our incomes are improving, and we can, if we're exporting more, that's certainly a sign of growth. So on the trade front, I would say that's another factor, but I think that the key of late has been some recovery in business equipment, and also, obviously, even though the consumer is constrained, they are making big ticket item purchases in automobiles, as we've seen.
Yes, indeed. A huge month, over 17 million yesterday. Let me ask you, though, about the wage question, because that's sort of to the forefront. And even today, the wage component in the services index, you know, was not as fantastic as we might have hoped for. Unit labor costs were actually down by 0.1%. Janet Yellen talking about pent up wage deflation. Do we have to ride through that before we see some wage pressures?
I'm not in the camp seeing significant acceleration in wages anytime soon. And that's one of the reasons I do think that what in effect she's saying is, yes, she's looking at the unemployment rate, she's looking at the participation rate, and I do believe that the Fed would have more confidence in the strength of the economy if you at least saw moderate acceleration of wages. We're not talking 4%, but I'm saying 3%. But on that score, I have to say that I'm in the camp that it's going to take a while to see that wage acceleration. But that will be a key indicator when it does happen.
When does the Fed begin to raise rates, and does it raise every month after that?
Yeah. The market consensus is it will begin about a year from now. So middle of next year is what the market's saying. And I think based on trends that I'm seeing in the economy, that's a reasonable expectation.
And a quick comment on the ECB's action this morning. Was it anticipated, and will it work? Will QE work? Yeah. Did it work in the U.S.?
A good question. First of all, was it anticipated? I've been so disappointed for so long by the ECB that I wasn't anticipating it. So when I saw it, I was happy. We also, in true confession, we do have a short position on the euro. So obviously that works well.
Welcome.
The next issue is, does the quantitative easing make that much difference to the economy? And I do have some doubts on that. My own view is that what the ECB really needs is a cheaper euro, more or less as the Japanese did, to make the overall zone more competitive.
Nick Sargent, thank you so much.
The Hayes Advantage, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern, in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Boston on 1200 a.m. and 94.5 FM HD2, or on Sirius XM Satellite Radio Channel 119. Copyright 2014, Bloomberg LP.